Welcome to Creature Feature, the show where we look at the intersection of human and animal behaviors, finding the beasts inside of us and the humanity hidden inside animals. I'm Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology at Harvard, and I pretend to be a bird on Twitter. Today we'll be talking about outlaws, animals and people who have turned to a life of crime. We'll answer questions like, dragons exist in Westeros, but can you also find them in Australia? What fishy business are aquatic con artists up to? And of course, the age-old question, who's your good boy? With me today is Alex Schmidt, comedian and host of the Cracked podcast. Alex and I are going to look at a couple of the most unlikely pyromaniacs from both the natural and human world. So, I live and I grew up in Southern California, where we don't have snow days, we have fire days. And instead of looking outside at this white winter wonderland, you see this orange sun and a red sky and ash raining down. And it was really scary. And I think it was this idea that you can have this relatively small fire that starts to burn out of control. And no matter how much we try to contain it, it just has this will of its own that can't really be stopped. And I think the reason I'm afraid of fire, those same reasons might be why a pyromaniac is actually attracted to it. The idea of this uncontrollable, huge event that just spirals into this massive inferno. So Alex and I are going to look at a couple of the most unlikely pyromaniacs from both the natural and human world, and we're going to try to find out what makes them want to watch the world burn. So, Alex, have you done crimes?
You're going to the jinx me? HBO's the jinx me right now? I don't think I've ever done any crimes that I can think of.
Yeah.
Like not a crime for sure.
Well, you know, crimes, we feel like crimes is sort of a human-only phenomenon. But I don't know. I'm here to challenge that notion that only...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Are they catching up to us?
They're the animals and the probably, you know, bacteria also are catching up. I don't think bacteria is... Anyways, they're catching up to us.
They're competition. That's
right,
for sure.
Right. They're barging into the organized crime of humans. So I wanted to talk about a few crimes.
Let's get into it.
I want to start with, to me, one of the scariest kinds of things, which is pyromania. Like, I've always had an enormous respect for fire. because it's very frightening.
Yeah, like there's a fire and you like tip your cap to it.
I'm like,
and you're like,
good day, Mr. Fire. Please don't burn me. I always call fire by its last name. But yeah, so pyromania is this fascination with fire. So, you know, most people kind of like you see a campfire and it's like, ooh, neat. But this goes far beyond that. It's
yeah, it is exciting even at a really young age. Like I was part of YMCA Indian Guides as a kid. And so
yeah,
we would go camping and do campouts. And like the dads would all be trying to start the fire, but we'd be all like, let me start the fire. I want to be the one, you know? And my family didn't do it, but a lot of families I knew would drive. I grew up around Chicago, and they would drive over the border to Indiana just to get fireworks.
Oh, wow.
Because they didn't sell them in Illinois, so they sold them at exit one of every Indiana highway. And you would buy them there and truck them all back and then just like light them off in a driveway.
Because they were illegal?
Yeah, you weren't allowed, yeah. And I've heard there's other states like that. Like, I think New Hampshire, it's legal. In Massachusetts,
yeah,
it isn't. There's a bunch of, like, symbiotic relationships where one state sells it to two states,
yeah,
you know? Yeah.
I lived in a very sort of in a tinderbox because I lived in Southern California in San Diego.
Ah, yes.
So fireworks were super not cool. And also just not really socially accepted because it was just like, don't burn us all down, please.
Oh, yeah, I'd imagine.
I remember one time my mom got us sparklers, which is not an illegal firework, but like I thought it was, and I was like, I was just dizzy with excitement. I was like, we're committing arson crimes on the 4th of July.
We're breaking California law.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
The strongest law.
The most exciting moment of my life, and it's all been pretty plateaued from there. But, I mean, it's interesting because pyromania is, it's not like arson where you're setting a fire to clean evidence of your misdeeds. It's like you, the feeling of setting that fire and watching the fire, and it's like, it's a thrill.
You're like that narration from Fahrenheit 451,
yeah,
but all the time.
Yeah.
If the whole book was just look at the fire, look at it burn, like there's no plot or nothing. Yeah.
Exactly. Can even be kind of like, it can be a fetish, which is weird to me because it's like, you know, typically it's like, well, you know, it can kill you. To me, it's like having a fetish of like the ocean and drowning.
Yeah. Wait. So you're kink shaming people who drown or burn to death?
Of course not. This is
death sex positive.
This is an extremely death sex positive show. So this is a crazy story.
Great.
There were a bunch of arsons in L.A. and this is in the, I think in the 80s, and the fire investigators were kind of stumped and. You know, they're chasing all these leads, not really finding anything. And they had their that old cork board next to my broccoli crimes. They were like, we got to get these fire crimes.
They should have just let the broccoli crime go. And then you, you know, combine the task forces.
But is there a connection? But yeah, I mean, there were serious fires. About four people died. Because, you know, that's the arsonist was setting fire to stores and while people were still inside. So it was very, very scary.
To stores. Wow. Like in metro L.A., like urban. Wow.
Yeah. And he would like set up incendiary devices and then like those would like slowly kind of go off so he could leave and escape and I guess watch from afar.
Man.
And this one investigator was like, this is weird. There's like a string of arsons between the arson investigation conventions, like the conventions for fire investigators. Like, there's like...
They have conventions?
Yeah, they do.
Oh, man.
Which sound really fun.
It's just a room full of people, like, carefully watching the room they're in. You know what I mean?
Like someone's like cosplaying as a fire and they're like, dude, not appropriate. Yeah. And so he's saying like, maybe the arsonist is a fire investigator and like nobody believed him. But then he was comparing the lists of attendees to the, like all the ones like where there were sort of like, he could draw a line. Like here's arson investigator convention and then a line of these arsons and then another one. And so he compared the lists of attendees to the ones that were the sort of the locus points. And he found about like, I think there were only a handful of people. So it made the investigation a lot easier. And they finally caught this guy, John Leonard Orr, who was an arson investigator. And he was actually briefly being consulted on this very case, like of his own arson crimes. And it was devastating because everyone was like, well, we had no idea that, I mean, he seemed really passionate about stopping fires, not causing them.
Well, he's like Fire Dexter. You know the TV show Dexter?
Yeah.
Like, where he's like solving
Fire
serial
Dexter.
Killer
yeah.
murders. He's Fire Dexter.
Yeah, exactly.
They should call it Fire Dexter and make
a
show.
Right. Wow.
Copyrighted here. We get to make it.
DM us.
Yeah. We need Fire Michael C. Hall. We need Fire whoever wrote the show.
I know so little about this that I cannot contribute to this bit.
That's all right.
Alex, you're going to have to carry the bit.
As you can tell, I do one actor's name, so pretty good.
Okay, here's the best part. I mean, none of this is good. Disclaimer. Fire arson is bad. Pyromania, doing it and destroying property and endangering people. It's
so
bad.
Much shaming on this show.
I know, but
man, oh man,
you know, it's just a little shaming.
I just want to commit a crime and die of it.
But okay, he was also a novelist, an amateur novelist.
Oh, perfect. And so he could write Fire Dexter.
He wrote Fire Dexter. No, he did. Alex, you were joking, but he did.
No,
he wrote Fire Dexter. He wrote about an arsonist called Aaron Stiles, and it was like he described all of his motivations and how he got like got a boner from starting fires and like and just all this insight into this character's psychology, which, you know, upon reviewing, you're like, maybe that's him. And then investigators worked out that Aaron Stiles, the name of the book's protagonist, is an anagram for I Set L.A. Arson.
What?
This is like, it's a book where when you would get to that point, you'd be like, come on, crime writer. What's a crime writer? Who does crime writings?
Oh, I don't know, Patricia Cornwell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, come on, like, two on the nose.
Yeah.
But it's crazy. It's like, get these guys on the Zodiac Killer. Why aren't they on the Zodiac?
Right. They worked out this, like, intensely constructed puzzle from where the call's coming from inside the police station or firehouse or whatever.
Like, okay, here, like, between the fire conventions, it's like a movie. And I am shocked and appalled that this movie has not been made.
Yeah.
Movie execs DM us.
Well, even not to celebrate this insane person, but like setting fires in stores, is he doing that because if four people died, I assume he set way more fires than that? Like, is he burning stores because he thinks no one will be in there at night or something? And so he can like get his fire without a death or something?
No, I think it was...
He's probably just a maniac. Yeah,
I think so. I think he set the fires like while people were still in it. It doesn't seem like he necessarily had the motive of killing people, but I think he just, you know, he was like a psychopath and he didn't care whether, you know, he killed people.
Right.
And maybe he did it during the day because it was more exciting. Like the idea of getting caught and doing it in public was more.
Oh, these were daytime fires.
Yeah. It could be like, it was just like people were around. He was just like, you know, witness my terrible fires.
Oh, man.
It's always confused. Like, they talk about it being really powerful, and it's like, it's always kind of confused me because it's like, it's really easy to start a fire, even when you don't want to. Like,
yeah. Well, like, all these people with these compulsions, like, it makes me glad I don't like anything. You know what I mean? Like, there's stuff that's cool, but I'm not, like, that into anything.
Yeah.
And it is probably really good for my life that I'm not.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you're that into anything at all, you become an Aaron Stiles or something, you know? Jeez.
I'm actually kind of surprised we haven't had, like, a Pyromania horror movie. You know, have we? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not a horror expert, so I wouldn't know for sure.
I mean, there might be one, but I can't think of one that's really, like, mainstream, where the kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre style, but he has, like, a flamethrower.
Oh, that would be awesome, actually.
It's, like, it's a lot scarier to me because it's, like, it's not just him, like, being there. Like, he's actively modifying the environment to be hostile to you.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's a he, but that's sexist. He or she, the or anyone, this fire villain.
Yeah, a fire person's person.
Yeah. I mean, they like, I guess in Avatar, The Last Airbender, they somewhat did that, but that wasn't really a horror. It was sort of...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's that, like, fantasy realm trope of, like, the classical four elements and fire as a kind of magic kind of thing.
Right. But that's not really the same thing because it's sort of, you don't get a sense of foreboding. It's just, like, action. Like, I think that I'm curious why I've never directed
because
a horror
movie. Because I'm lazy, Katie. I haven't gotten around to it.
Alex's horror movie, like, when Snoopy comes by.
There's my roast, bud. We're doing it.
Yeah, you should follow Alex's Twitter @AlexSchmitty.
At Alex Schmitty, yeah.
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 Where he posts Snoopies sometimes.
Yeah, I don't draw him, but I feel like a picture of Snoopy playing the saxophone is just generally more exciting than most of the tweets I see. And I encourage people to just start posting that instead of tweeting. Yeah.
You won't find an argument here. But yeah, I'm just like, I don't know, just imagine being sort of like being chased down a dark hallway and then you run to the other end of the hallway, but then that's on fire. So you have to go back and then the killer is there. It's like, it's such a scary.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's, they're controlling everything around you, and you're just sort of haplessly trying to escape.
Yeah, it almost feels like it'd be a Batman villain or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Because they have that for everything else. Like, there's a guy obsessed with the calendar and everything, you know?
They have the ice guy, which is much less scary than fire. Like, who's afraid of ice?
Yeah, yeah. They basically need a fire version of Mr. Freeze. That would be great.
Fire to meet you.
Just the exact same pun structure, but you put in the word fire.
Comedy genius.
You all need to fire out. It doesn't make sense.
I'm going to flame away. I don't even think that was a joke by the Freeze guy.
Schwarzenegger could sell it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've got bad news for small animals in Australia.
A platypus just dropped its iPhone. What?
It's like one of those news stingers, like, bad news for animals in Australia. And they're like, oh, crap. But after the commercials, oh, damn it. So there are these birds of prey that are not just satisfied with screaming fiery anger down at the little animals. They're also like, no, we'll set actual fires and flush the little mammals out and then eat them.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's definitely a new discovery. So there's not been anything that, like, there's not, like, solid research behind it, but they're basing it on anecdotal evidence of researchers and also the indigenous population has long known about this or long documented, and they call them firehawks. And they have this really cool... They have this cool ceremony where people will act out as birds carrying smoldering branches. And, you know, I think that's really convincing that this has definitely been happening for a long time. And so, like, the birds will, it's not that they start a fire from nothing. There's, like, a fire that exists because they're not.
Okay, yeah.
They're not agile enough to, like, take a flint and... Just like they've got like they're trying to do the thing where they get the stick and the thing and you're rubbing the stick really fast. So the right. friction causes the fire, like with their little wings. Like, but they pick up like a smoldering stick from the existing fire.
Okay.
And then carry it over to a prey dense area where the hunting is good. And then like set a fire and then. Like them and all their buddies just kind of like as like the little lizards and little rodents, like they get out of the fire and like, phew, at least that's over. Oh, no. What's really crazy is like these birds, these like pyromaniac birds that are extremely scary for the little rodents. Like,
yep.
But they may have actually helped shape the savanna.
Oh.
Because if they're spreading fire, they're changing the environment of the savannah. They're like, I'm not a fire expert, but I would assume it has a lot to do with, you know, you're kind of creating new growth and getting rid of old growth. And
yeah, that's a thing in some ecosystems, I think. Like growing up in Illinois, we had the mostly former prairie, you know, it used to be the entire Midwest. Now it's just very specific spots, but something that we were taught frequently, especially because sometimes we'd see like I lived near one and there'd be a column of smoke coming up from it and I'd be like, that seems wrong.
Yeah.
But we would be told frequently like prairies need to burn with some regularity.
They must burn.
Yeah.
To please the prairie gods. Which is a prairie dog spelled backwards.
Thank you for celebrating my faith. So a guy with the name that's an anagram for I Love Burning Prairies would tell us that you need to burn the prairie because, like, the plant, there will be too many old dead plants in it, and they just need to be cleared out.
Yeah.
And then as soon as it burns, like, that charred stuff becomes very good fertilizer, and there's, like, a lot of benefits to just consistently burning down some prairie. And so they would do that, and maybe the Australian environment is kind of like that. I guess they have a few kinds of environment.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it you know, fire definitely has an impact on the...
Yeah, in the outback or whatever. You know. Yeah.
But it's really, I mean, like, definitely keep your eyes open, everybody, for research about these birds, because, like, you know, not it's all on right on the cusp of like finding out what's going on, and it's really exciting.
Yeah.
Because I think that'd be crazy if like birds setting fires to terrorize rodents like shaped the Australian outback. Just like it's like, you know, we think of big environmental change as being something like big, like a glacier, not like this like little falcon with like fire.
Right, like a very slow period of time,
right.
Not like
right.
just a jerk bird.
It's like, yeah. Burn it!
Well, it's amazing, too, that you said that science is just starting to maybe prove this, and there's a local tradition where people reenact it.
Yeah.
Like, they're fully like, we all know this is happening,
right.
and we do a thing.
Right. I mean, yeah. I would bet that it's probably sadly a new trend for researchers to actually pay attention to non-Western cultures.
Oh, these are like Aboriginal peoples.
Yes, yes.
Indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
I don't know what I should call it. Yeah,
yeah, I'm sure that's okay. But like,
yeah,
so they've had this long documented. So it's like, you know, it's kind of interesting. We sometimes, you know, don't pay as much attention to non-Western histories. But I think it's really great that the researchers are working with, like, you know, the native culture and... That's
yeah.
really cool.
And against the birds. Take that, birds.
We must unite to defeat the birds. It's like how we end all hate is just fighting birds. Though pyromania in today's society is destructive behavior, at some point early humans had to have an arsonist streak to be able to learn to utilize fire. How did we go from being fearful of flame to actively trying to tame it? One clue may be in the behavior of chimpanzees. Primatologist Jill Peretz witnessed the strangely calm demeanor of chimps in the midst of a wildfire. People in the region do controlled burns to clear the land and aid in hunting. Though most of the animals flee in terror, the chimps seemed relatively unflappable. Peretz observed that, quote, "They were so calm about it, they were a lot better than I was, that's for sure. I was surprised at how expert they were at handling the fire." She also saw male chimps doing a, quote, "fire dance." It's a dominance display that was modified to be slower and directed towards the fire. This may be an indication of how human ancestors began to master their fear of fire and a foreshadowing of Burning Man. Let's take a moment to cool off with a few messages. Back soon with more Law Break Environments. So cheaters represent a huge conundrum in evolutionary biology and also in human philosophy. Adam Smith, the invisible hand dude, is a famous economist and author of The Wealth of Nations. He's often credited as the first proponent of the idea of the free market, the unrestrained ability to compete. So here's the problem. If nature or human society operates in a free market, wouldn't it become inundated with scammers and con artists? How can a group of social animals remain stable when the rewards of cheating are so damn good? Any cooperative society should, in theory, crumble, because natural selection will always reward swindlers. Steve Frank is a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California at Irvine. He studies the problem of cheaters in evolutionary genetics, and one of his talks took an unexpected turn towards moral philosophy. He pointed out that there's a lesser-known second part to Adam Smith's work, a book called Moral Sentiments. In this work, Smith re-examines the idea of the free market, pointing out that if it's in a collective's interest, they will work together to suppress the activity of those taking advantage of the group. So, are free markets never truly free? Alex Schmidt and I will discuss whether fish might have the answer. Later, we'll find out what your genome has to do with moral philosophy. Alex.
Yeah.
Are you ever gullible for things?
Yes. Just generally. Yeah,
oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have something like jumping to mind immediately for it, but I feel like I spend a solid chunk of many days or weeks just being like, do you mean that for real? Because
right,
I'm like
right.
earnestly interested.
Yeah.
People will joke about like, yeah, I guess I'd like go to the moon or something. And I'm like, so you're interested in being an astronaut? For real? That'll pretty frequently happen for me. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not trying to put you on the spot because I'm very gullible too. Like I, sometimes I don't pick up on sarcasm or like someone will say something incredible. I'm like, oh really? Because like I like to think of it as just being very open-minded.
Yeah, I would be very excited to be surprised by life.
Yeah,
just all of the time. And so a lot of times people will think they've nailed being completely over the top with something crazy, and then no, they haven't. I want to find out if that's true.
Yeah,
let's do it.
I've always like, whenever people say, "I have a bridge to sell you," you know, like you fall for someone's prank, and they're like, "Oh, I have a bridge to sell you." I don't get it because it's like, okay, I don't. Why would I want a bridge? Why would you be selling me a bridge? But I just found out that, well, first of all, I found out what it means, which is that, you know, the idea that you would trick someone into thinking that person would own the bridge and then would sell it to you. But it was based on an actual con artist. His name was George Parker. He was criminally active around the turn of the century, and he would literally sell people the Brooklyn Bridge. And
oh, wow.
I mean, this is a new fact to me. I apologize if like everybody knows this, but me, I'm just like, do you guys know this?
Because I think I know a bridge sale story, but I don't know if it's the same thing where like somebody sold the London Bridge to some town in the U.S., something like that.
Oh, I don't know that one.
But they also thought they were buying what's actually called Tower Bridge in London. Mm. It's the famous one. That has very tall towers on it. And then every other bridge across the Thames is like just kind of a regular bridge. And so they moved this enormous regular bridge to this town.
Yeah. That's crazy that there's like more than one bridge scams. Like,
I don't know who's buying them.
No. Like, and I don't know, like when you're trying to be a con artist, you're like, well, what would be a good con to pull? A bridge.
Right. The classic maneuver of selling infrastructure. Ah.
Sexy infrastructure. Infrastructure is hot right now.
That is a con and different from just getting a job. Yes. Yes.
So George Parker, he would also sell things like the Statue of Liberty, just landmarks and pieces of property he definitely did not own, but he had like, he forged documents, and so it's like, see here on this paper, it says, I own the bridge. I will sell it to you. And like, and some people would like actually go up and set up tolls on the bridge thinking they were now the owners, and police would be like, oh, buddy, no. Or what? Right. Like, I guess it was the turn of the century. It was like, listen, guy.
You got squeezed, see? And then they just kick him out.
Yeah. Well, so I want you to go on an imagination journey with me, Alex.
Oh, shoot. I'm ready.
About a very strange scam. So imagine you're going in. Well, first of all, you got to imagine you have really long hair.
Okay.
Like Jesus levels of great hair.
Great. I'm there.
Yeah. Okay. You're there. Good. And you just kind of want general trim. You maybe want some layering and styling a la Jesus.
Right.
And, you know, you're just kind of relaxing. And then you turn around and you notice, like, all your hair is on the floor in big piles. You're like, what the heck did you just do? I don't look like Jesus anymore. I look like, you know, John Stossel.
Wait, so they gave me an incredible mustache in the process of it? Maybe I'm on board.
So
maybe
the hair has fallen onto your upper lip. And the hairstylist apologizes, saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I misunderstood. I thought you wanted a big... And you're fuming because, you know, you had been oiling and conditioning this hair for months and it was great. And and you leave in a huff, and then you return, and you look in the window, and there's a wig that looks suspiciously similar to your hair, your wonderful Christ-like locks.
Yeah, and then I go on TV and Stossel them out of business.
You Stossel them.
I do an amazing report about it.
You go on Yelp and go like, this John Stossel is unhappy.
Yeah.
This is an actual thing, but in Fishland.
So Fishland does not clarify to me.
All right.
Where we are.
Seaside-y.
Oh, Swimtown. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Swimtown. Swimtown. Great. Swimtown, Ocean, Oceansburg. So I'm sure you're saying, like, well, fish don't have hair, Katie. You're dumb. Good point.
I'm mean.
Yeah, yeah. Calm the heck down, Alex. God. There are little, these really pretty little fish called cleaner wrasse. And they do this incredibly important function for coral reef communities because they're like the coral reefs, which are all dying, are so cared about, not just because they're pretty, but because they are the homes of a huge variety of fish. And they all kind of congregate there like a little, just like in Finding Nemo. Finding Nemo is like,
yeah,
basically a documentary.
They're the big cities of Swimtown.
Right, right.
That's it. Yeah.
It's the Fishcago. that wasn't the best wordplay I could have done, but Alex is from Chicago.
Yeah, that was the one closest to my heart. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
I should have said Shipcago, but also fish don't do ships. They don't need them.
Yeah, no, ships are like intruders. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So never mind, that was fine. So fish have this mucous membrane covering them, and it protects them. It's like, if you've ever had a fish tank, sometimes you put in stuff like stress coat, and that's sort of like, it's to keep this membrane healthy, and it protects their skin. But they also get little parasites, which are really bothersome for fish because they can't scratch.
Right.
So the little cleaner wrasse go up to the fish and he's like, hey, buddy, you want your body detailed? And they will go all over the fish and pick off these little parasites. And fish will line up for this like they're at a little car wash. And just be like, just patiently waiting, like, oh boy, it's my turn next.
Right. Like an enormous barbershop situation.
Right, right, yeah. Right. But there's only one barber. So yeah, it's and you'd think like, that's perfect. Fish are wonderful. We could learn a lot from fish.
We could.
But here's the problem.
Oh no.
Is that slimy mucousy stress coat that I was talking about? It's apparently real good. It's real good tasting. It's super delicious.
I'm gonna need a second opinion on that.
Well, in Fishland, it is like, yeah, it is the prime. For a little cleaner wrasse, it is like their crack. So they really want to nibble on this sweet, sweet snot coat. And but the fish don't want that because it's like, my slime, give me back my slime. It's bad for them to get their slime chewed off.
Yeah, their protective bugs. Gotta have it.
And so this is where it gets like really interesting because this is like economics in fish. Okay, I'm going to make economics sound really fun because it's fish.
Finally.
Yeah.
So boring.
So the cleaner wrasse, which are the little con men, sometimes are, you know, they want to get at that mucus, but they will, they'll try a little nibble every once in a while. And the fish are like, hey, don't do it. And then the fish, if they're noticing that the cleaner wrasse is nibbling too much on their cool slime, like, they boycott them. They stop going to their business. and it's like they get on Fish Yelp and they're like, don't go here. He'll eat your slime. I didn't come in to get my slime eaten. Just the bugs on my skin. And they'll actually, the cleaner wrasse, if like the fish shows anger, which I'm not, I guess fish show anger by kind of chasing them around and like making a real like, oh, you face.
they don't yell like Albert Brooks. Like, yeah.
Why I oughta. but then they'll kind of like, they'll try to placate the angry customer by kind of like giving him a little massage, like, I'm sorry, buddy.
A massage?
Yeah, yeah.
This is like, I am so glad we are a species that can like deal with our own self-cleaning and like has hands and arms and stuff. Like so much of the animal kingdom just goes around waiting for another animal to clean it up. Like those rhinos with little birds on them.
Right.
Just like, oh, somebody help. Like what a nightmare.
Yeah.
We're the best. Really great.
But there is that like the blind zone, like right sort of like that one spot on your back that's a blind zone. But then you can do the bear thing where you like, you know, get like a nice jagged wall and get that blind spot.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
We're the best. We're
so
all
we're
set.
The perfect animal.
Yeah. And I didn't know a fish could give the equivalent of a massage because they're handless and they're freaky and I don't know how they do it.
Well, I it's kind of like they sort of like go up to them and kind of rub their like dorsal fins against them or something. It's sort of weird.
It's like the back scratch with the wall. Like,
a little bit. Like it's not, they're not quite like getting in there and like, you know, actually sort of like doing the little chopping motions on the back. And then like there are like market forces. So when there are plenty of clients, the cleaner rats will take more chances and do more crimes, which, you know, is kind of like similar. Like when there are companies that have no competition and lots of customers, they'll try to get away with stuff like offshore bank accounts or like, you know, eating people's mucus.
Now I have a new thing to compare the cable company to. Perfect.
Time Warner always eating my slime. They also cheat less when they notice that they're being watched by potential future clients. So they're like, oh no, I might get Yelped.
Yeah. What do we need? Can we call it Kelp Yelp? How's
Kelp. That? Oh my God! I could have just said Kelped.
Kelped.
Oh,
yeah.
Damn it. But that's great, yes.
Thank you.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
I'm
just a, kind of a pillar of Stone Town community, you know? Keep it going.
It gets really sophisticated. So the cleaners will perform extra services for big fish that are sort of from outside the reef.
Literal big fish, right. Yeah, sure.
So, like, it's sort of like if you've ever... I don't know, people who've ever had office jobs or something where you have people flown in, important people kind of coming from like corporate, and then like they get to cut in front of the gosh darn lunch line because they've been flown in and they're important, I guess.
Right.
But yeah, so they're trying to reward these fish for choosing their particular reef. And they're like,
man,
hey, come on back to Joe's Reef because we give you dorsal fin massages.
That's such a... I'm just realizing that as humans, we have so many idioms for like somebody being a big fish or even like a whale, you know?
Yeah.
Like they're a very important
or
client.
Shark Tank.
Yeah, Shark Tank, yeah. Like we use the ocean to describe most business, and the ocean has business going
yeah,
on too.
Yeah, it's like, it's sea capitalism. Let's revisit Steve Frank, the evolutionary biologist with a fondness for moral philosophy. Frank has an interesting idea on Rawlsian ethics explaining the human genome. John Rawls was a 20th century moral philosopher who spent a lot of time thinking about fairness. One of his theories was the veil of ignorance. It's the idea that in order to create a truly just and fair society, you should make the rules while still naive about your place in that society. So you don't know if you're rich or poor, man or woman. So when you craft the laws, you want them to be equitable and fair to as many people as possible, since you don't know which one of those people you're going to be. It's like if you have a pizza and you're tasked with slicing it, but you don't know which slice you'll be given. You'll try to make the slices as even as possible, so you'll be given a fair portion no matter which random piece you'll get. On the genetic level, you're doing this all the time when you're creating sperm or egg cells because you have paternal and maternal genes that they both want to get in that sperm or that egg. And in order to do that without competing with each other, there's a randomized process called fair meiosis, where essentially you're slicing up that pizza at random, and the maternal and paternal genes have an equal chance of getting into one of those baby slices, which means that as long as they're working together to make you really fit and make your egg and sperm really fit and thus your offspring really healthy, then they have a good chance at winning that lottery and getting passed down. With that, we will be right back. We're going to hear a message from some of our awesome, awesome sponsors. One of the earliest lessons we learn as children, other than don't touch fire, don't hit your sister, and don't feed forks to Mr. Toaster, is that stealing is wrong. Stealing so undermines a society of rules and laws. Historically, there have been some pretty gruesome penalties for theft. Cutting off ears, hands, and noses were common in ancient Egypt and medieval Europe. In England, during the 1700s, pirates were killed and their bodies were hung up on gibbets, which are tall wooden beams that held cages, which were used to display the decaying corpses of criminals. Even worse, sometimes live pirates would be displayed in the cages, left to die of exposure or thirst. In 1723, there was the simultaneous hangings of 26 young pirates, whose bodies were buried between the high and low tidal water marks, which was thought to ensure their souls would never be at rest. So, what is it in the life of a vagabond that's so appealing? A longitudinal study found that 16% of people polled reported having stolen something worth more than $50 in the last year. Most thieves aren't career criminals. Their flirtation with the pirate's life typically only lasts for about a year. Alex and I will discuss the motives behind human kleptomaniacs and why the life of a pirate calls to seabirds and landbirds alike. So there is an English comedian who, sadly, he just passed away. His name was Ken Dodd, and he...
I don't know his stuff, but great.
No, but yeah, I mean, I actually didn't hear about him until I was doing research for this, and he has this excellent quote. He says, I have kleptomania, but when it gets bad, I take something for it.
Yeah.
Got him.
Good one, Ken. Man, such a classic joke.
I know, it's like, great. It's like a million dads all cried out at once. So kleptomania, as you may know, it's an impulse control disorder, and it's different from stealing because they're not actually taking things they want. They're just like stealing things almost for the thrill of stealing it. And it's not
right. Like the broccoli was there.
Yeah, like I don't want broccoli. I just want to do broccoli crime. So it's something where it's, I feel a lot of sympathy with people who have kleptomania because it's kind of more of a control thing. Like maybe they feel like something has happened in their life where they've lost control, like a family member dies. And like that can be a trigger for kleptomania because it's kind of like, it's like having control over a certain thing. Like I can take that item. Like I can be sort of completely autonomous and get that thing.
I never would have thought of that. That's cool.
Yeah. And it's also like the thrill of it. And it's completely irrespective of class, economic class. It's like rich people will be, you know, the most famous of which, Winona Ryder, back in Beetlejuice times. Or a little after Beetlejuice times.
Yeah. There was a whole... I had forgotten about that. There was a whole in-between where she was mostly being joked about on late-night TV for shoplifting.
Which, you know, when you think about it in retrospect, it's kind of a little crummy. Like, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because in particular, if it's being done by people who have plenty of money, or at least have earned money at some point.
Right.
Like, yeah, it must be some kind of compulsion. And again, like I said, I don't like anything very much, and it served me well. I'm very lucky.
Yeah. But what's interesting is, so, like, there's, in evolutionary biology, we don't call it kleptomania. We call it a, or I say we as if I am evolutionary biology and I direct horror movies. But they call it kleptoparasites, which sounds a lot grosser.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Yeah. It sounds like an alien parasite that like goes right in your eyeball or something.
Yeah, I'm imagining like a shark with a remora on it, and the remora has like a bunch of bags of loot and stuff, you know, like.
I stole your 401k plan. It's capital C-ism.
C-capitalism.
C-capitalism.
Yeah. Corporate raider, pirate capitalism.
So it's parasitic behavior where one party is benefiting at the expense of another party. And it's so cute. It's the cutest parasite in the animal world. So especially when it's done by birds. So
another bird crime. Here we go.
This is a bird crime heavy episode because there are so many bird crimes.
Yeah, they're just you keep hearing about like, oh, crows, it turns out, are brilliant. Like
right.
They should be writing books or something because they have such brilliant brains. And it's like, yeah, they're using it for evil, though. Can't trust them.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on with these birds that you should keep an eye on.
Yeah, well, there's bowerbirds, which they're really pretty birds that develop these elaborate bowers, like kind of a grassy area that they've constructed, and then they put little decorations in it, like here's some blue flowers and here's some colorful rocks, and they're very particular. They pick out certain colors, and really bright colors like reds and blues and violets, and like put big chunks of colors in. And the hope is that will attract a female to come to their little grass cave that they made on the ground because they put a bunch of pretty flowers. And it's kind of great because when they live near civilization, they will steal things like bottle caps and little pieces of like colored glass, and so they just like have this little junk heap, but it's all color coordinated, so it's really cool looking.
Oh yeah, I think I would come across it and imagine it was like a weird kid did it.
Right.
You know? That's amazing that a bird can do that.
But then they also do thief crimes because they're like, you know, instead of just finding their own bottle caps and colored piece of dirt, like they gotta take someone else's. There's this great segment of, I think it's either Life or Planet Earth, where David Attenborough is narrating, and this little bowerbird is like trying to present these colorful objects to this other bird that he thinks is a female bird. And he's like, "Would you like this? What about this toy heart? What about this?" And like the bird is like, "Yeah, it's pretty good." And he like just takes it, and it's a juvenile male, not a female.
Oh.
Because the juveniles have coloration similar to females. They haven't developed their pretty little crests yet. So, like, the bird was, like, trying to... It's just, like, some teenager, like, going, "Yeah, sure, bro." And he, like, just steals it from them.
Even the teen birds are untrustworthy. No teens.
And then chin-strap penguins, which their names are already great because it makes me think they're wearing little hats with little chin straps right on to keep them on because, like... Their heads are small, and it's hard for the hats to stay on, so they gotta secure it down.
Are you thinking of Pittsburgh Penguins, the hockey players? That's, yeah.
They do something very similar, where they will steal rocks from each other. And it's really sad, because one penguin will be, like, being honest. So they build these big rock nests, too, and then the females are like, "Hey, is your... rock nest the best one? If so, I will mate with you." For more information, see the documentary The Pebble and the Penguin.
The Pebble and the Penguin.
Right.
Wow.
Directed by Donald Bluth, I believe. It's a cartoon. It's a cartoon movie.
Remember when you asked if I was gullible before?
Answer is yes. I watched a lot of non-Disney movies like Troll in Central Park and The Pebble and the Penguin, and
I don't know any of that. I think I saw like No Don Bluth as a kid. Yeah.
But it's a movie. It slightly misunderstands the real penguin behavior.
The rock economy.
Right.
Going. Yeah.
Because they have, they're like finding pretty rocks or nice stones for the females, like just one of them, which is like, I guess, you know.
How much of the animal kingdom do you think has some kind of capitalism? Because apparently the sea does, and penguins do, and these weird bowerbirds do. And, like, I don't know, maybe capitalism is, like, throughout animal species, and we just think we're the only ones.
I think that there's a strong possibility, except for, like, you have bees, which are communist.
Oh, yeah.
Damn commie bees.
Yeah. They should go extinct. Wait, don't. No, no, I take it back. There's no more Earth.
So the while the kind of hardworking penguins are going, like, I'm going out to collect my rocks, like the evil
right.
penguins going,
just
like,
putting in a solid day in the rock mines.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm gonna steal your rock.
Like the seven dwarves in Disney, you know, just you mine it, you bring it back.
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting science about, like, well, how can you have, like, a cheater and not have society collapse? Because you would think, like as soon as the penguins would catch on, like, oh, there's someone stealing, then they would just be like, well, I'm going to steal too.
Right.
But there are certain forces that seem to, like, you know, there's definitely, like, with the cleaner wrasse, it's really interesting because in that case, you have direct punishment for stealing. And certainly when penguins catch another penguin stealing, they, like, honk at him and go, like, hey, you wise guy.
That's penguin kelp yelp, is just honking. It's like, it's just making noises like the Batman villain, the penguin. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Like one went out of five went. So, and then another bird crime, just a real brief one. Quick bird crime.
Almost too many to count. Don't trust birds.
Seagulls will steal fish right out of pelicans' beaks in broad daylight.
Oh, man. For real?
Well, are you really surprised? Like, do you ever...
They, like, pry it open?
Well, I mean...
Oh, man.
I don't think they can do much prying, but, like, I think they just slip in there while the door's ajar.
That's true. It looks like a loose setup,
right,
that pelican
right.
beak. Yeah.
Right. Right. He's kind of like, they just, like, get right in there.
Well, did you see this story, like, just hit Facebook and then the wider media? This Canadian guy who he stayed at a hotel in, like, British Columbia about 20 years ago. And it's basically this crazy, insane, elaborate story of him trying to bring pounds and pounds of pepperoni to his Navy friends.
What?
Already nuts. And then he was in a hotel room where, like, there wasn't a place to keep it cool. And so he left it in an open window. And basically he came back to his room and it was a sea of seagulls eating the pepperoni and, like, violently pooping the pepperoni everywhere, too.
Oh,
and then
no.
he got a lifetime ban from the hotel.
Oh, shouldn't...
But then it appealed it recently, and they were like, this is such a funny story, you can come back.
Right, shouldn't the seagulls have gotten the ban?
You know, you would think, yeah. But it was, like, such a fracas. Like, the room was demolished. Like, there was no... It was just covered in... Because also, apparently, it was, like, a spicy pepperoni that seagulls can't digest very well.
No.
So they weren't harmed, but they were just, like, really pooing
it.
They
were, like, pooping caustic poops.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no.
And then he, like, tried to throw a shoe at one, and both the shoe and gull went out of the window down into a crowd that was meeting for, like, high tea or something, and, like, hit them. And then, yeah, it was just, like,
dignitaries from several countries where we have tenuous diplomatic relations with.
Yeah. Right, right. And, like, that's how a war happened, yeah. But yeah, it's like seagulls apparently just go for it.
Yeah.
Like, shooters shoot, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they want it. Yeah.
Yeah. They will, like, grab the food out of your hands if they think they can get away with it.
Yeah.
Which is not really, that's not usually the style. Like usually animals are, and people are a little more, like, subtle about it. Like, you kind of, you're like, I realize you can't see me, so I'm gonna sneakily take your pizza, not just like, we're coming in, we're gonna eat this pizza, poop all the floor, and charge you like $700 worth of movies.
Right.
Eat everything in the mini fridge, and those little bottles of water are like $20 each. But, like, do you remember, like, I don't know, actually, I wonder if, like, you were the perfect child, but, like, when you were a kid, did you ever try to get away with stuff? And, like, do you remember that realization where it's, like, if I'm not being watched, I can do a thing. I can do bad things and not get in trouble.
I don't remember like a mental transition, but that certainly becomes a thing pretty early on. Yeah. Of like, there are times when I'm being watched. There's times when I'm not. Also, there's heaven and hell and my Catholic upbringing, but we're going to figure it out.
I mean, like children do actually kind of go through this learning of it's like this theory of mind where they understand other people have a different perspective of the world than they do. They have their own distinct mind, their own distinct sort of perception. And so there's this really mean child study where it's like they have they present these children with stickers, and they have three really like lame stickers and one like awesome race car sticker. Like the other ones are like
cool sticker,
bland flowers or creepy porcelain dolls, and like one's like it's like Lightning McQueen, and like the kids are like, oh man, I want that one.
Yeah.
But the rules of the game are when the kid points out, and the rules aren't explained, I don't think very much. The kids kind of have to figure it out, where whenever they pick a sticker, Mean Monkey, this little toy, will steal that sticker from them. Because Mean Monkey gets to pick first, and then they get to pick. And Mean Monkey always picks the sticker that they want, the race car one that they wanted. And so they're really sad. And that's around age, you know, like a little bit older than toddler. And then like
I was hoping you were going to say like 17.
If only teenagers were so easy to fool.
Stickers.
But then when they get a little older, just like about a year older, like once they reach about 4 years old, they're like, they figure out how to like kind of be deceitful. And they like when they're like, okay, now choose a sticker, they pick one that they don't want, one of the non-race car ones. And the expressions on their little faces are so funny because they're like grinning from ear to ear, like knowing what they're getting away with. But like they realize that, okay, he can see me doing this thing.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to trick him.
I want a child development study on when poker face becomes a thing. Because like, yeah, they probably learned it, but they can't hide it at all, which is great.
I imagine like it's when a parent says like, it's like, did you do this? And they're like, no. But like, I remember when I was in the first grade, I was like startled at my own intelligence because I was like, I found the secret system. Like, if I want to play with toys in class, I just do it under the desk and the teacher can't see. And I was like, this is incredible. It's like discovering the alchemist stone of misbehavior. It's like, oh my God, I can turn boring time into gold. And then when I got caught, I was like stunned because I was like, well, she can't see my hands. Like, what? How is that even possible?
Right.
She has X-ray vision. My teacher is a mutant.
Yeah, but she actually saw like your shoulders moving or like you going pew 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 or like something like that.
Right, doing little voices like, I'm Mrs. Blanchard. I'm really stupid. Well, what's super cute is that dogs and chimps also have this understanding, and it's really cute. Like, so they know that when they're being watched by an authority figure, and they know that there are consequences to something like stealing food.
Okay.
And then they wait until they're not being watched. So in chimps, they test it with like a dominant chimp versus a subordinate. And the subordinate like is shown like where some food is hidden, and it's shown that the dominant like can't see it. And they go in and they like run up really quickly, like grab it and then run out really quickly.
So somebody's just studying like chimp schemes.
Yeah, chimp schemes.
Great.
The chimp going like, nyah, 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 nyah.
Right, like Chimp Ocean's 11. Just like 10 of them in a room, like, this is how we get to the banana.
It's like 5 feet away, and they're like, here's the plan. But like animal behavior experts are starting to study dogs more because the realization is dogs have this really good social intelligence. And it's really funny because they, in dog's case, like the authority figure is the human. And they'll put like a piece of food on the floor, and the dog's like looking at it like, oh my God. And then the human is like, no, you can't have that. And the dog looks devastated. It's like, no.
Oh.
And then the researcher either sits like in a chair and faces the dog, or faces away from the dog, or like these are the different experiment conditions.
Yeah, yeah.
Like there's one where they kind of look a little distracted and one where they just completely leave the room. When they leave the room, almost 99% of the time, the dogs just immediately take the food and eat it. When they're still in the room, but like facing away from the dog, they'll still try to steal it once in a while because they're like, you can't see me, you can't see the food, you know, might as well. And when the person is facing the dog, much less often do they try to steal it, but sometimes they do. And it's really funny when they do, because like one of them walked, like there's the food and the researcher in the chair. And then the dog like walked around in a big circle behind the researcher, went under the chair, and then like took the food as if like somehow he's like, you weren't expecting me to come from this direction.
I hope he did like the tap the opposite shoulder trick that people do. He's like the, on the way.
He's the Penn and Teller of dogs.
What did the dog do when the scientist leaves the room and then watches them through the eye holes of like an old-timey painting? Like, do the dogs suspect it's haunted?
The dogs kind of like walk through a background that keeps looping, and then they're like, whoa. It's funny because like my dog, like I can see it a little bit in my dog. Like she knows she's not supposed to go in the bathroom because she always raids the trash. And like if she can tell I'm like watching her, she won't go in because she knows I'll just close the door.
Yeah.
But other crimes, she'll just do right in front of me. Like she sees me looking at her and she very slowly like reaches over and then grabs my glasses and then runs away and is like, just, like,
your glasses.
Yeah. And like it. I know dogs can't laugh, but it seems like she's laughing because she's like, ha. and she's using it as like a hostage because then she wants me to give her treats.
Oh, man.
In exchange. Because I thought giving...
Oh, right. Then ransom it. Yeah.
I may be a bad dog trainer because I thought like, okay, like you teach your dog to drop it and then you reward them. I've just rewarded her for finding items that I don't want her to have and then dropping it. Like, actually, just last night, I dropped, I was doing some chopping in the kitchen, and I dropped a knife, and...
Just love that broccoli, huh? All the time. All the time with the bread.
Just chopped broccoli up into little pieces and threw it right in the trash. And I dropped the knife on the floor, and, like, she tries to grab it.
Yeah.
And it was just, like, so funny. Like, I mean, she didn't get it. We got it away from her, but just like she was so close to like becoming armed and being like that primate in 2001 Space Odyssey where he's like, oh, this bone can kill.
Right. From now on, I am knife dog. I only respond to knife dog.
Well, I think on Knife Dog, I think we are going to... So. Even though it turns out all dogs aren't going to heaven, do they at least feel guilty about their shenanigans? Dog owners are probably familiar with that sheepish look on your pet's expression after a naughty incident. The eyes look up, the head lowers, the tail may even go between the legs. So is this a form of doggy conscience? Researchers think that regardless of those big puppy eyes, your dog doesn't have an ounce of remorse. Dog owners were asked to leave the room while their dog was presented a biscuit, but told not to take it. The owners returned, unaware of whether their dog was naughty and took the biscuit or was obedient. Asked to rank their dogs and how guilty their expressions were, the owners were completely hopeless. They couldn't tell which dogs were felonious and which were innocent. So this research suggests that the look of guilt in a dog's expression may merely be a reaction to our visible anger at them. They may not know why you're mad, but they know they're in the doghouse, and they'll make sure to look pathetic until it all blows over. In fact, dogs may have us figured out more than you would guess. According to studies, we express emotion more strongly on the right half of our faces. What's really interesting is that dogs have a preference for gazing towards the right, more strongly emotive half of a human's face, even though they show no such preference towards any other animal. This means that dogs may have an ability to lock onto the most expressive part of our faces to better judge what emotional state we're in. In fact, they may be better at it than humans. Unlike people, dogs will still lock onto the right half of the human face even when it's upside down. So, if you ever find yourself dangling upside down from an inconveniently placed rope trap, your dog will be able to make the astute observation that you are upset. Truly, man's best friend. So, Alex, do you have anything else to plug other than your new movie Knife Dog?
Yeah, I mean, just people see that in theaters, get tickets on Fandango.
Hit that like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe to Knife Dog.
I'm so glad to be on the show. Thank you for having me. My Twitter account is @AlexSchmitty, and I'm on Cracked every week. So
not on crack.
Drugs are a problem.
Drugs, don't do them. Don't do them. Drugs, don't do them. Can find me.
Knife Dog is tough on drugs. It's like the new McGruff.
Knife Dog, I'll cut you if you do drugs.
Yeah, like a criminal McGruff, the crime dog.
Yeah, like I will hurt you if you try to do drugs. So you can find me on Twitter @ProBirdRights, my Twitter for birds, but not only for birds, for people who are
it's the best
who
guys.
Like birds too, and politics and birds. Birds and politics.
If people are still sleeping on that account, get on it.
And also @KatieGolden.
Same for that account.
Where there's some pictures of a muscular Garfield on it. I don't want you to be alarmed. Just giving you a heads up.
They'll like it.
Thank you so much for listening. Hope you join us next Wednesday on Creature Feature.